All right, you know what? I don't care what Janet Yellen's thinking anymore. How do you like them apples? We're going to wrap up the economic week that was today from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. September the 18th today, a Friday this one is. It is great, as always, to have you with us, everybody. So, anything happened this week, economy-wise? Anything worth a mention, you think? Yeah, probably just a couple, right? Its initials start with Federal Reserve, and that is where we're going to start the next 4 minutes of our collective lives. Here to wrap things up with us are Lee Gallagher. She's at Fortune Magazine. David Gura is at Bloomberg. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so David, let me start with you first. Were you surprised at the hold?
I remember talking to somebody at work about this, and she said to me she could see this going either way. She would be equally surprised no matter how it went.
Yes.
So we had the Fed meeting. We were expecting Janet Yellen to either raise rates or not. She decided not to. The whole committee decided not to. I was just struck by what a parlor game this was throughout the week. I mean, we've had such volatility, and there's been so much uncertainty. The rate didn't go up, and here Janet Yellen cited exactly that, the volatility and what's been going on in global markets, singling out China in particular, where we've just seen the valuation of the currency and the government just trying desperately to buoy markets over there. So was I surprised? I was a little bit surprised.
A little bit. Lee, what about you?
I wasn't surprised, but it just, like you said, it's enough to make you want to pull your hair out because it kicks the obsession can down the road. That's all it does. And you have to wonder, okay, so rates may go up by the end of the year, but are things really going to change that much between now and then? And the answer is no.
Okay, so wait. So there's a flip side to this question, right, Lee? Have we, the business media, and I guess maybe you blame the Fed too, but have we been mixing up the messaging on this one? Have we just driven this out of all sense of proportion? And mea culpa, I mean, I'll raise my hand.
I mean, I think yes, but I think that it's not just the media. I think it is the investing public. It is Wall Street. It's everyone who follows the markets much, you know, minute by minute and much more closely than maybe you or I do. So I think that I think there's legitimate concern over this. But I also think, you know, you don't want to market at 0%. 0% is not where you want to be. And so it's a good thing to inch it up even ever so slowly, which was going to be the Fed's plan to do it really slowly,
and
but
then
now we're putting that off.
And then, David, no matter what happens, everybody's going to go, oh, my goodness, they raised rates, right?
Exactly. Right. And, you know, I'm just struck. There was a great moment in that news conference she gave yesterday where, you know, she was just sort of acknowledging the fact that she's heard an earful from everybody.
Right.
So that's
right.
The media. That's all sorts of special interest groups. So you've got a Fed that's just, you can say, increasingly aware of what the markets and others are telling it.
All right, so let us turn now from monetary policy to fiscal policy. And the fact that David Gura, I can't even believe I'm saying this, we are talking about another government shutdown.
We should be upfront with the listeners that you've brought me back because you couldn't bear to go through this again.
I couldn't do it alone, man.
So many of these things. So, there's been this debate here about funding for Planned Parenthood, and that may force a government shutdown here in just a number of days, I think 5 days from now. And it is. Here we go again. And then on top of that, you know, the potential for another debate over the debt ceiling and what's going to happen to the highway trust funds. So this is illustrating, Kai, why I left Washington. I just couldn't take it anymore and how happy I am to be in New York.
Lee, you're shaking your head. I mean, you're laughing, but I can hear it.
It's like I can't believe we're here again either. I mean, it was devastating last time. And the fact that, again, this is like a scene out of a movie. You can't believe that
really
politicians would really let it come to this. It's I think it's really tragic. And I think there's a likelihood.
Oh, really? You do think
yes.
there's a likelihood? Oh, man. All right. We're going to do 47 seconds now, David, on you get 25 and Lee gets 25, and I know that doesn't add up, on the debate and the lack of economic questions. Yes, it was supposed to be foreign policy, but really not much economy in that debate at all. David Gura.
No, and there were a lot of non sequiturs going back and forth from, you know, North Korea to talking about, you know, vaccines, all sorts of stuff. But the carried interest tax loophole did come up. And this is something that Donald Trump has talked about closing. And you did see sort of, you know, a divide emerging here with some candidates talking about their willingness to see that closed. This is something that President Obama has wanted closed for a long time. This is the way that profits on you know, that hedge fund managers and private equity guys make is taxed. But you're right. It was not by any means an overwhelming topic there at the debate a couple days ago.
I've been working on this one all week. You ready? Thank you, Senator. pretty good, right? Lee, were you surprised at all or no?
I was not surprised, but largely because I was surprised at how little it came up during the first Republican debate.
Yeah.
And that one was all topics were on the table and it didn't come up at all. And I was surprised that, yes, carried interest made a cameo, which is kind of funny because that's a topic people haven't been talking about for a while. But if the economy does come up, I would think it would come up in the context of inequality and jobs and,
right.
and you know, because that's even the Republican side is really talking to those issues as well now. So right. I was surprised. Yes.
Thank you.
We did get
Senator.
Secret Service code names.
We did. Well, don't even get me started. David Gore from Bloomberg and Lee Gallagher from Fortune Magazine. Bye, guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Equities were unhappy today. We'll leave it at that. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Fed's decision yesterday not to decide to raise interest rates is good news for borrowers. Money can't get too terribly much cheaper than it is right now, as David and Lee and I were just talking about. But you know who was hoping for a hike? Banks, that's who. They have been warning investors about a looming decline in third quarter revenues. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson explains why rising rates could have helped.
Even if they weren't expecting the Fed to raise rates yet, some banks were hoping it would. Which might seem a bit counterintuitive when you consider that raising rates can mean fewer people borrowing, and that while banks earn interest, they also pay it. But those rates won't rise equally, says Gerard Cassidy. He covers banking stocks for RBC Capital Markets.
A rise in short-term interest rates would enable the U.S. banks to reprice their loans to corporations and companies due to the fact that they are variable rate loans.
But when it comes to their deposits,
the banks traditionally are very slow to raise those rates relative to how quickly they raise the rates for loans.
Cassidy says banks aren't really worried about irking customers because their deposit levels are really, really high right now. Jim Paulson is chief investment strategist at Wells Capital Management.
Banks have a lot of deposits, an abnormally large amount of deposits, even by historic standards.
Which is another reason they'd like to see rates rise. They're not able to earn much interest on those deposits. And then there's stock price. After the Fed's announcement, investors sold off bank shares. They had been hoping a rate hike would boost banks' profits.
It's a double whammy when you think about it, because they not only, you know, don't get additional income flow off their deposit balances, but they also have their stocks take a hit at the same time.
I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
There were some numbers out from the Labor Department this week that deserve a mention. It's called the Bureau of Labor Statistics Census of Fatal Occupational Injuries, and it showed that the overall rate of fatal injuries on the job last year was about 3 out of every 100,000 full-time workers. That's across all occupations. But for the oil and gas industry, where long hours and dangerous equipment are commonplace, that rate was more than 5 times greater. Marketplace's Annie Baxter reports.
The Bureau's report says 142 people died last year from work-related injuries in the oil and gas sector. That was an increase of 27% from the year before.
Well, we've known for quite a few years that it's a high-hazard industry.
Kyla Retzer is an epidemiologist who focuses on safety in oil and gas extraction. She says well sites are dangerous places, with multiple companies taking heavy equipment down or putting it up. But Retzer says transportation is actually the big killer. Unsafe rural roads, no seatbelts, fatigue.
Every year, there's at least one or two incidents where a crew of workers are driving together and the driver falls asleep at the wheel and there's, you know, multiple deaths.
One solution? Some oilfield companies have installed monitors on vehicles to track how workers drive. Carrie Cutting is with the North Dakota Petroleum Council, a trade group.
They really can monitor everything that goes on in that vehicle. And at the end of the day, your supervisor is sitting there with a record of your driving experience of the day.
But Denver attorney Randall Kelly says another problem could be the culture of machismo among oil and gas workers. Low-skilled workers could, at one point, make $100,000 a year. Kelly says some keep quiet about unsafe conditions.
Because, you know, if you don't keep this job, you know, how are you going to make even close to this with your skill set?
Kyla Retzer, the epidemiologist, says if there's one good thing about the downturn in the oil patch, it could be that there's more time to think about safety. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Boy, it's been a long time since we talked about the Greek debt crisis, huh? In part, that's because of the migrant crisis that is topic A in much of Europe right now, but also because we are in that phase of the debt mess where we are just waiting for Greece to qualify for the next chunk of its bailout money. The requirements are nothing new: reforms to its pension system, deregulation of the labor market, and deep cuts in public spending. And also, there is this. There's a general election in Greece this Sunday, and the current Syriza government of former Prime Minister Alexis Tsipras is at some risk. From the European desk, Marketplace's Stephen Beard reports.
In the birthplace of democracy, enthusiasm for elections is waning. The Greeks have had five of them over the last 6 years. Enough, says Christine Zwicky, who runs this bookshop in central Athens.
It's becoming a little annoying at the moment because there's no point to have more elections. We need stability at the moment, and this is not helping.
Since the last election in January, which brought Syriza to power, the economy's contracted, and she says business is bad.
Yes, it is worse, even worse, definitely worse than it was a year ago.
Worse than before, Syriza and its youthful leader, Alexis Tsipras, were swept into office. He promised to end austerity, but that spooked investors and depositors. Greece slid back into recession. Eventually, Tsipras caved in, accepting the creditors' demands for more budget cuts and reform in return for a third bailout. And he faced an angry backlash on the street and among his erstwhile supporters in Parliament. 25 lawmakers broke away from Syriza, forming their own anti-austerity party called Popular Unity. That prompted Tsipras to call the election. Adonis Georgiadis, a conservative opposition member of parliament, is not impressed.
Syriza was a disaster. No government in the history of the Western world in 7 months managed to harm a country so much as Mr. Tsipras and his party did to Greece.
None of the Syriza politicians we approached were available for interview, but some of their ex-supporters were.
I voted for Syriza in the last elections. I vote for Popular Unity now.
Stefanos Simolas Kritikidis is 27 years old, a university graduate and a bicycle courier. With 54% youth unemployment, it's a job. He's abandoned Syriza, he says, because it would bring in more job-destroying austerity.
It is going to make life here even more difficult than it is now. Especially for the youth here, life is unlivable.
But both Syriza and the main opposition party are committed to cut spending and reform pensions in return for financial aid. Economist Professor Panagiotis Alexakis.
This is our last chance to actually implement all these measures. I think that there is no other way. This is accepted by the great majority of the people now in Greece.
Whatever the outcome of Sunday's election, the debt crisis should subside. But as the Greeks exercise their democratic rights, we shouldn't forget their other great classical legacy, drama. At the European desk, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
Coming up.
I thought at times I could stand in the middle of Woodward Avenue reading War and Peace and not get hit by a car.
Author David Marinus and his new book about Detroit. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrial's off 289 points today, 1.75%, closed at 16,384. The NASDAQ down 66 points, 1.33%, 48.27. The S&P 500 down 32 points, 1.6%, ended things at 1,009.58. For the week, the Dow off 0.3%. The NASDAQ gained 0.1%. The S&P 500 lost about 0.1% or so. Financials flopped, as you might have gathered from Tracy's spot. Citigroup slumped 2.75%. Chase ran down 2.75%. Bond prices, well, they rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note down to 2.13%. You're listening to Marketplace.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Palo Alto Networks. As you innovate to transform your business in today's digital world, how do you stay secure? At Palo Alto Networks, our mission is to protect your digital way of life. Whether it's unprecedented opportunities or uncertainties with AI and whatever comes next, we continually deliver innovation to make each day safer and more secure than the one before. More at paloaltonetworks.com.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. Lorene Powell Jobs, Steve Jobs' widow, has done a lot of work as an education philanthropist. A group she co-founded called College Track has helped send thousands of disadvantaged high school students to college. She has now launched a $50 million crowdsourcing campaign to reimagine the American high school. From our education desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott has that story.
In a slick video promoting the competition, a woman wearing an astronaut suit appears to float above a crowded city street, shouting,
"Are you with me, America? Let's rethink high school!"
The campaign is dubbed XQ, the Super School Project. Lorene Powell Jobs is board chair of XQ Institute. She says high school as we know it goes back more than a century.
It was designed for early 20th century workforce needs. And as we all know, in the last 100 years, the rest of our world has changed radically, but schools have not.
Take the traditional lecture-style class.
Teachers have told us across the country that what's severely outdated is the teacher at the front of the classroom as the font of knowledge, because as we know, access to knowledge and information is now ubiquitous.
Not everyone has equal access, but why bother memorizing the Platt Amendment when you can look it up on your smartphone?
Instead, teachers want to help students learn how to think, and they want absolutely relevant learning so that students can understand the applicability of what they're learning to the problems in the world that they're going to be faced with.
So what could that look like? Rashid Davis has some ideas. He's principal of P-Tech, a new technology-focused high school in Brooklyn, New York, and he's helping promote the competition. Davis says the next generation high school should collaborate with colleges and employers. His school partners with IBM.
Every student has an IBM mentor, so they get to experience the worlds of work by leaving the school and actually going into work site visits. They have the opportunity for paid internships.
And the end goal is an associate degree in applied science, setting students up for careers. Of course, people have tried to reinvent high school before. Jack Schneider is an education historian at the College of the Holy Cross.
That idea is as old as students sitting in desks and a teacher lecturing at the front of the classroom.
Schneider says in the mid-20th century, there was a movement to make high schools much bigger with more courses to choose from. 50 years later, people decided high schools were too big. The Gates Foundation spent $1 billion promoting smaller schools. Neither was a smashing success. Schneider says while high schools may look stagnant, they've been evolving all along.
I don't think the high school is perfect. It's far from perfect. But to say that the process isn't working when we have the world's largest economy and when we have a more or less functioning democracy, you know, I don't see the outward signs that the educational system is failing.
But if you've got an idea for making it better, you'd better hurry. The competition's first deadline is November 15th. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Amy talked to Lorene Jobs for a good long while. You can hear the rest of that chat at marketplace.org. I was in Detroit the past couple of days doing some stuff that we're going to get on the air in the next week or two. One of those things was a conversation with author David Marinus. He's got a new book out about Detroit. It's set in the 1960s, the 18 months or so from late 1962 to the spring of 64, when the city seemed like it had never been stronger. Ford and GM and Chrysler were selling cars to beat the band. Motown was becoming nationally known, and Detroit was a center of the civil rights movement. Yet, at the same time, the city had already started falling apart. David Marinus was born in Detroit. He lived there till he was 6 and a half. So when we set up the interview, we thought we would do it in front of the house that he lived in when he was a kid, right at the corner of Claremont and Dexter. Except the house isn't there anymore. The same thing that's happening in much of that city.
And it was big enough that it probably looked a lot like that brick one there. It might have been right here where the rubble is. And my brother and my big brother and sister and I would sit on the porch, and they would quiz me on the 1955 new model cars as they drove by. You know, that was the thing to do. The Nash Metropolitan, DeSoto's, all these cars that are long gone.
You say in this book a couple of times that Detroit has this hold on you, as it has for a lot of people, right? What took you so long to write this?
Well, I have to become obsessed with something to write a book about it and devote 3 years of my life to it. And it was bubbling up inside me, probably, and then it was the right time. It just felt right. I was in New York City watching the 2011 Super Bowl on TV, and at halftime, this incredible commercial came on with Eminem driving through the streets of Detroit. And, of course, it was just trying to sell Chryslers, but it sold me on something different. It struck, I mean, I teared up watching it. My wife said, you know, you sucker, what are you falling for that for? But it made me start to think about why Detroit. Of course, it meant something personal to me, but I think it's such an American story. And I wanted to remind people, along with the shadows of the Troubles, what Detroit gave America.
It's a character-driven book, this is. You've got the mayor, Kavanaugh is his name.
Jerome Kavanaugh.
Walter Reuther.
Reuther, of
the United Auto Workers. John Kennedy is in this book. Berry Gordy from Motown. I wonder how much of what we think of Detroit today is because of those people.
Well, it depends on what people think of Detroit, you know. If they think of the Detroit of ruins, I don't think so. But they think of what Detroit gave America in terms of music and cars and civil rights and labor, yes, those are the people. Walter Reuther, who led the United Auto Workers, I think is one of the most important figures of the 20th century who has been neglected to some degree. What he did in terms of bringing up the working middle class. You can't underestimate Berry Gordy and what Motown means to the soundtrack of this country. And then you have Henry Ford II, the Deuce, who was leading Ford Motor Company during that period, and he and Lee Iacocca helping create the Mustang. So I think that all of those things are what people can remember about Detroit. Whether that's what they think of first now is another question.
There is so much that happens in this book, in this time frame of 62 to 64. Martin Luther King and the first version of I Have a Dream and the March for Freedom and the Olympics bid. There's so much that, I mean, and I read a lot of history. There's so much that I didn't know. What surprised you?
Well, I didn't know much of it. I didn't know that King gave his I Have a Dream speech here first. I didn't know that Detroit was so close to getting the Olympics. And, you know, that's counterfactual history. But imagine if the Olympics were held in Detroit in 1968. You know, the year of Black Power, of Tommy Smith and John Carlos in Mexico City. The year after the riots in Detroit, would things have changed? Would the power structure in Detroit had been so attuned to the city that the riots might not have happened or have been dealt with in a different way? We don't know, but it's one of those great counterfactual questions.
When you drive through Detroit today, as you have, I can't imagine how many times in the past couple of years as you were working on this book, what do you think of?
Well, I think two things. One, it's a city of beautiful architecture. It's a city that's depopulated. I wrote in the book a slight exaggeration that I thought at times I could stand in the middle of Woodward Avenue reading War and Peace and not get hit by a car. Since over the course of the 3 years that I've been here, it's become a little more energized every visit back. I tell people it's a great place for if you're 22 to 35 years old to come and reinvent yourself. That same creativity in a different way that was played out in Motown 50 years ago can be played out in music and arts and food and so many in tech today by young people. But there's another thing, and like we're standing here where a house that I was born in or came to when I was born no longer stands. And there are vast swaths of Detroit that were single-family homes for the working class, black and white. And so much of that is gone. The jobs are gone. The people are gone. And until Detroit can bring that back, it can't be a full renaissance.
David Marinus, it's a book called Once in a Great City, A Detroit Story. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you, Kai.
We've got a chapter of David Marinus's new book on our website. It is, once again, called Detroit, Once in a Great City. Also, the Chrysler ad that got him started on the book in the first place. It's all at marketplace.org. Final note on the way out today, a detour into the bond market, the really old bond market. Bloomberg News reported this week that Yale University is going to get a check for €136.20 as partial payment on a Dutch Water Authority bond that was issued in 1648. Yes, ceremonial, but still cool. Yale bought the bond 12 years ago as an historical artifact, paid €24,000 for it, about $27,000 or so. No, clearly not a great investment, but the school's endowment is $24 billion-something, so they're doing all right. And that, on a Friday of Fed Week, is all we got. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We will see y'all on Monday. Have a good weekend. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.